conversations that I was expecting to use. So what I have today is actually a slightly different proof. It's maybe a little quicker to show the circuits you get are not quite as efficient. So what was I proving, just to remind you? So I wanted to prove that the symplectic group of 2n dimensional binary vectors, or of matrices on over acting on 2n dimensional binary vectors that preserve the symplectic inner product, is generated by the three gates H, R, and C0. Again, applied to whichever qubit or pair of qubits. So R, H, remember, is the Hadamard transform, C0, I'm sure you remember, and R is the Clairement 4 phase rotation, so 1i diagonal matrix. Now, to remind you, so C0, remember, when it acts, when it does the Clifford group action, it takes x tensor I to x tensor x and so on. So what that does, so you remember, you're writing the SP2NZ2 as a 2N by 2N matrix, which we can think of as four blocks, A, B, C, D. The top half, so the columns, well, okay, so the basically what happens is each vector gets mapped to some appropriate column, right? So like x1 gets mapped to the first column here, and x2 gets mapped to the second column, and so on. So the kind of the left half corresponds to the images of the x's, the right half corresponds to the images of the z's. The upper half is the x parts of all those images, and the bottom half is the z parts. And so C0, so if we multiply something like this by C0 on the left, so we do this gate and then we do a C0 gate, we get a new S symplectic matrix, which has been changed in this way. So C0, I guess C0 between I and J, so with the I qubit as control, the J qubit as target, the C0 will add the ith row in the top half to the jth row, also in the top half. So this is on the left. And at the same time it does that, it adds the jth row on the bottom half to the jth row in the bottom half. Ith row in the bottom half. So it's what it's doing on the top half and what it's doing on the bottom half for reverse, basically. So in Hadamard, acting on the ith qubit, well, what does Hadamard do? Remember, it switches x and z. So x and z are top half and bottom half. So the Hadamard switches the ith row from the top half with the ith row in the bottom half. And what does R do? Well, R takes x to y and z to z. So what that does, if you multiply on the left by it, is it adds the ith row in the top half to the ith row in the bottom half. Okay? And I claim, so what I'm going to do this time is actually It's a little easier if you multiply both on the left and on the right by these things, kind of more efficiently get to where you're going, which is the identity. So I'll say in a minute what happens when you multiply by these on the right. But it turns out that it's helpful to have a couple more gates that are composite things. So what do we have? Well, OK, so one easy one is the swap between I and J. And you can get that out of this because, well, you have a circuit like this made out of C naughts, which implements the swap. So three swaps gives you three C naughts gives you a swap. And well, this does the obvious thing, right? It just swaps the I and J rows. In both the top and bottom half. And what else do I need? I need the controlled Z. And so this is equal to, you can again get it from these things. By doing Hadamard on second qubit, so this is between I and J. Hadamard on second qubit, then do a controlled knot, and then another Hadamard. And what this does, it turns out, if you work it on the gates, if you work on the matrix, and you multiply by this, it adds the ith row in the top half to the jth row of the bottom half. And the other way around, the jth row in the top half to the ith row in the bottom half. Okay. And let's see. So then there's one more matrix I'll need, which I'll call Q of I. And so this one is going to be the Hadamard. It's going to be what happens when you combine these two. So it's just H R H. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's right. That's right. When you multiply on the left side. And actually, so okay. And so so what does this do? Well, H switches the top and bottom half. And then R adds the row from the top half to the bottom half, and H switches them back, right? So this is basically the opposite. So this adds the ith row of bottom half to the ith row in the top half. And as I said, I may be using some of these on the right. I'm not going to write down all the rules. But the basic thing, if you work it out, is that if you multiply on the right by these things, well, first of all, rows become columns. So for instance, the Hadamard will switch the ith column from, and left becomes, and top goes to left. Bottom goes to right. So the Hadamard, for instance, will swap the ith column on the left with the ith column on the right. But unfortunately, there's another complication, which is that everything works kind of in the opposite direction. So for instance, the control not adds the, in the, maybe this can just be completely done by switching left and right. But anyway, so the control not actually adds the ith row, and so in the left half it adds the jth row to the ith row, and the right half the ith row to the jth row, so it's the other way around. So is that the same as switching this left and the right?
No, it's only the top one that has I and K.
Well, it's not just, it's not switching I and K.
No.
So for instance, Q is now adding the, so instead of adding the ith row at the bottom, to the, it's actually adding the ith row in the left to the ith row in the right. Or ith column, I should say. So maybe it's enough to switch this to top goes to right, and bottom goes to left.
Daniel?
Yeah.
So I was thinking that once we have a swap of two rows, right, and we have that one row can get added to another row.
Yeah.
Right. Then we can take it to edit.
Well, not. There's a complication, which is that we have this thing about top half to bottom half. So
yes.
C naught, for instance, adds rows, but it does it also in the bottom half.
Yeah,
the
but then place. We have the other controlled Z, which takes the top, the top to the bottom. So
well,
there's flexibility
right.
both ways.
Well, that's right.
Pardon me?
So this is basically what we're going to do. The complication is that what you want to do, just adding one row to another by itself, that's not a symplectic operation. So there's no way you're going to get it by multiplying these together.
No, yeah, I understand.
Okay.
But there'll always be like you add one row to the other, but you'll always get like some other row also getting added to the
That's
other.
Right. That's
so,
right.
So there you just want to make sure that you have like a zero sitting there in the column that you're concerned with, right? So that you can achieve with swaps. Once
yeah.
You
well, that's good. That's
zero. Then you can achieve. With
that's
swaps.
That's basically right, and that's kind of the outline of what we're going to be doing for this proof. But before I do that, are there any questions about these actions?
But in that, I was wondering, do we need column swappings?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
I mean, but if so, we still have them because we have swap back to the right, we'll swap column.
Yeah.
Or the Hadamard will swap from left to right. But okay, so everyone gets basically the idea of what these actions are doing. So what we're going to do, remember, is find a set of things we can multiply on the left and on the right by to transform this original matrix U into the identity, right? And then, by multiplying by the inverses, we'll see that U is equal to the product of those inverses, right? Inverses on the left, inverses on the right to get rid of all these extra things. Okay, so how do we do that? So the first thing we want to do is we want to put a 1 in the upper left corner. Step one. So how do we do that? Well, somewhere in the first column there has to be a 1. Why is that? Well, this matrix has maximum rank. We know that because, well, all zeros. So it has to preserve commutation, anti-commutation, right? It has to preserve the symplectic inner product. So every non-zero vector, like the one that, well, every non-zero vector will anti-commute with something, right? It'll have the non-zero symplectic inner product with something, whereas all zeros vector doesn't. So nothing can get taken to zero. So every column of this matrix has to be non-trivial. It has to have maximum rank. And so there has to be a 1 somewhere in the first column. So what we're going to do is we're going to move it into the upper left corner. Of course, there might be more than one. So there might be more than one way to do this. We're going to move it to the upper left corner. And to do that, we might have to use Hadamard. So we might have to use swap, obviously, to move it around within A. And if A was starting, the first column of A was starting all zeros, then there has to be one in the first column of B. And we use Hadamard to move it up. So using Hadamard and swap, we can do this. OK, what's the second step? Well, now we can use control not from the first qubit to the ith qubit to get rid of all the rest of the ones in the first column of A. Right, so we add, if we look at it and if there's a 1 in the ith spot, we use control not from qubit 1 to qubit I. That adds the first row to the ith row and cancels that 1 in the first place. Right, so now the first, so A now looks like something like this. 1, zeros here, and then something else. Right. This is just part, of course, of that big 2n by 2n matrix. This is n by n. OK? So the next thing we want to do is we want to get rid of the first column of C also. So how do we do that? Well, we have this controlled Z operation, which allows us to add the ith column from the top to the ith column to, sorry, the ith row at the top to the jth row at the bottom. And we have R, which allows us to add the ith row at the top to the ith row of the bottom. Okay? So the 1, 1 position, the upper left corner of C, if it's 0, then we leave it alone. If it's 1, then we add the first row of A to it, right, using that R operation. And then similarly, for the other ones, we get rid of them using the controlled Z operation. So now the first column of the whole U matrix is just a 1 in the upper left corner and then 0s all the rest of the way down. Oh, whoops, sorry, this is the wrong order. This was actually step 4. Same mistake in my notes, actually. So step 3 in here. So what I'd like to do is now get rid of the first row of A also, right? And we can again use that using C knots. But this time we multiply on the right. So C naught on the right, so we have to do it the other way around, right? We have to go from the ith row as control and the first row as target to get rid of ones in here. But we can do that and get rid of all of these. Okay? Because it adds columns. Right? Okay. And so then we do what I said and get rid of the first column of C. And the reason I had to do it this way around is, well, I guess I didn't really. Yeah, okay, I was thinking about the back reference, but that's on the right-hand side. So it doesn't matter. So we could have done it the other way. Okay. So A is in this form, and C we've gotten rid of the first column. And actually I'd like to get rid of the first row of C also, but it turns out I don't have to. First row of C is already zero. So why is that? Well, this is a symplectic matrix. Right, so what we know is that the columns here are originally commuted because they're all images of x operators, right? x1, x2, x3, through xn. So they all the columns on the left-hand side commute. Zero symplectic inner product, and the first column is just a 1 in the first place and a 0 elsewhere. So say we have the first column, A1, C1, we take the dot product with AI, CI, the ith column. Well, what is this equal to? Well, so we have A1 dot CI. A1 is just a 1 in the first position and a 0 elsewhere. So that's equal to C1i, right? So the first row, the ith column of C. And C1.ai, but C1 is all 0, right? We made that in step 4 here. So that's 0. So this is actually equal to C1i, and we said that this has to equal 0. Right? So it's already 0. So the row operations that cleared this A also cleared C. Or at least, well, if we'd done it in the other order, it would have been that way. This way is the anything we did, the R of I might have done it. And I guess it couldn't decide it there. But yeah, so it's the row operations. The right hand, it was the column operations that did it in set 3. Okay? So now C has this form. Right, so C is now reduced to basically an n-1 by n-1 matrix. And A, well, it's almost an n-1 by n-1 matrix, except for that 1 in the upper left corner. But basically A and C, the first row and column are gone. So what we can do is repeat the process using just remaining n-1 rows and columns. And we're never going to have to involve the first row and column, so they're not going to get messed up in any way. And so when we're done with that, we'll have A is the identity, and C is equal to 0. Okay? Everyone see that? Yes, no, maybe? Okay. Okay, so now we're getting there. We've gotten control of the left half of this matrix, gotten it where we're going. So now what I'd like to do is get rid of B. Well, to do that, I'm going to want to multiply things on the right so I can do column operations. And, so the diagonal elements of B I can get rid of them by adding, by using, it turns out now it'll be the Q operation, which is going to add the ith row, the ith column on the left to the ith column on the right. And since there's, well, since A is now the identity, it has ones in the diagonal, and so we can get rid of any ones in the diagonal of B by adding it. Right. Any ones anywhere else in B, we can get using the controlled Z operation. So there's, I guess you have to, again, apply this condition to see that you can do that because you're adding two things at once. But it's going to work just fine. And what you'll find is that you can make B zero.
Ben?
Yeah.
Why does control Z help?
Control Z is going to add. It's the backwards. It's backwards. Wait. Okay. So now maybe now we may see if I was wrong to. Wrong just with the left and the right.
So Daniel, the way we made C zero, if you do the column operations, wouldn't B become zero?
No. No, I don't think there's anything that forces it. So that's easy to see. I mean, in fact, some of these basic operations have that property. Like I think Q is just on one qubit looks like 1101. So the point is, there's something that can take x to x and z to y. Okay, so x to x means that a and c are basically what I said, identical zero. But z going to y means that b is not zero. So let's see, control Z, what does it do? So the control Z matrix if you multiply this one right, okay, you're right. So we don't want to use the control C. What we want to use is the Hadamard transform control C. So if we have something that goes the wrong way around, right, it's switching, it has left side and right side reversed, we can do Hadamards to switch left and right, do this gate, and then do Hadamards again to switch it back. Right? So the Hadamard control Z will add the columns from the left to the columns on the right. So using these two, then we can make B zero. Okay, and then, as it turns out, that is enough to ensure that D is the identity. But why is that? Same idea. So now let's take the inner product of the columns on the right with the columns on the left. So these are Z's, oh, sorry, not up there. Columns on the right, the BD columns with the columns on the left. So this, so these commute if they're acting on different qubits. This is an X bar and this is a Z bar. If they're acting on different qubits, they commute, but if they're acting on the same qubit, they should anti-commute. So this is going to be delta ij. And what is it equal to? Well, ai is 1 in the ith position and 0 elsewhere. So ai dot dj means that we pick out the ith element of dj. So we have dij. And well, ci is all 0, so the dj just gets killed anyway, even though it was 0 to begin. Okay, so this is saying that dij is delta ij, so d is diag. Sorry, let's say delta. Okay, and that means we're done. You've taken u to the identity, and then by, so, but we've multiplied the original u by things on the left, things on the right, as the identity, we take the inverses on the left and the right, and that will give us the original u as a product of these things. Okay? Yeah?
So Daniel, I'm wondering whether, the following approach would also work. That if you've taken we've made the column, the first column, one all zeros, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then
you mean including C?
Including C.
Yeah.
Then we just swap if necessary to make the second row, the first entry, I mean the 2x2 entry being one.
Yeah. Here.
Yeah. And then we again make everything else zero. So then we basically take it to a lower triangular matrix. Sorry, upper triangular matrix.
Oh, sorry, you're not even worrying about the rows here.
Yeah, I'm not even worrying about it.
Okay. Okay, so you want to do that, sure.
So we take it to upper triangular, and then we start doing the reverse operation to then take it to identity.
Yeah, that would probably work. It's a little dangerous because, well, the reason I didn't want to do it that way is because, well, when you add a row operation here, then you're doing a reverse row operation here. So making both of these upper triangular at the same time is probably not the right approach.
No, not both of them.
You just make
whole matrix upper triangular. No, so we made one and all zeros, right? In the whole matrix, in U, we made one and all zeros, the first column.
Yeah.
Right, including A and C, right?
Right.
So one and all zeros. Then the 2x2 entry, we make one by swaps.
Oh, I see. So you want to make all the columns of C0 by row operations.
Yeah.
Not just the lower diagonal part.
No, yeah. The entire matrix, we make it upper triangular.
No, see, that's going to be difficult because what's going to happen when you do a control Z, right? So suppose you made A upper triangular, but then you do a control Z to try to get rid of something on the bottom. Well, you're doing it both ways, right? You're doing these two things. Control Z is adding the ith row to the jth row in the bottom half, and the jth row, the top half, to the ith row of the bottom half. So you're doing two, you're adding two rows to the bottom half at once. So you have to be careful about that kind of thing. I mean, it may work. Right? So it's because you have these symplectic relations that may force it to work.
No, but Daniel, I mean, we were successful in making the first column one and all zeros, right? Not just in A, but like in A and C together.
Yeah. Right? But the reason I could do that is I didn't have to worry about adding other things. I feel like what you're saying will work because of the symmetries. But you need to prove something to show that. It doesn't immediately work. The reason I wanted to do it this way, getting rid of the rows here, was so that I didn't have to worry about these things. Other questions? The details of this are obviously not very important. I wanted it, partly for completeness and partly to show an example of how you can do these stabilizer and Clifford group manipulations. Frequently it's helpful. I mean, row reduction is just one of these very common, useful things. Shows up, well, everywhere, but in particular in this class, it shows up when you're doing these manipulations a lot. So it's helpful to have an experience of at least seeing it. And maybe you have some experience now. Depending on how you do the problem set, you might have also experienced it there. Okay? So maybe it's time to move on to new stuff. So what I'd like to do today, probably for most of the class, maybe all of it, is talk about bounds on quantum error correcting codes. When can they exist? What are upper bounds? What are lower bounds? So let's start with the lower bound. So this theorem is called the quantum Gilbert-Varshamal bound. So called because there's a very similar classical Gilbert-Varshamal bound, which I assume was invented by Gilbert and Varshamal, but I don't actually know the history. And what this is a lower bound on the existence of quantum codes. So it's a condition, if you satisfy this, then you know there exists a stabilizer code with a certain set of parameters. So what it says is, suppose you have these parameters NKB, meaning the usual things. And they satisfy this equation. So K equals 0 to D minus 1, N to J, 3 to J, is less than or equal to 2 to the N minus K. So then there exists an NKD code, which, because I've used these square brackets, is actually even a stabilizer code. Okay? So the significance of this quantity is that it's the number of errors of weight less than D. Well, okay. Number of errors, by which I mean poly errors. Well, there's n physical qubits, right? So there's n choose j subsets of qubits that we could have this poly error act on, right? And each of those qubits, we could have an x, y, or z. And of course, if we sum from j equals 0 to d minus 1, then we're summing over all possible weights up to d minus 1. Right? So this is basically the number of things that can possibly be less than the distance. So possible undetectable errors for this code. Okay? Okay, so to prove it, we're going to use, this is actually a harder proof than the later bounds that I'm going to show you. Well, in the next couple of bounds, there's more complicated one later that might have been their proof. But the way we're going to do this is by counting codes. What we're going to say, so this is kind of why, this. I mean, if you did the problem set, this is why I asked you to count the number of stabilizer codes. We don't actually need the answer, but it's going to be the quantity without, it's going to cancel out the end, so we don't actually need to know the answer, but the quantity of the number of stabilizer codes is going to show up in this formula. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to make a list of all stabilizer codes encoding k qubits and n qubits. And we're going to cross off from this list anything that has, so we're going to look for each code, we're going to look in the set n of s minus s, right, the set of undetectable errors. And we'll cross the code off the list if it has anything of weight less than d in that set, right? So it's obviously a very inefficient procedure. We've made this huge list of codes, and then we're looking at each one exhaustively to see what its distance is, and we're crossing it off if the distance is too small. Okay, but how do I know how many codes I've crossed off? Maybe I crossed them all off. But it turns out that we can set some bounds on, and that's where this Gilbert Fartzoma bound comes in. Okay, so so there's some number of errors, which is up there. This is actually a function of n and d. E sub n d errors of weight less than d. And so the way we're going to cross off codes is, well, instead of looking at each one to see what its distance is, we'll look at each error, okay, of weight less than d, and cross off any codes that have that error in n of s minus s. Right, of course, this might be redundant. I mean, obviously, some codes will have a couple of things of weight less than d. But at least this will definitely get rid of any code that has distance less than d, right? Okay, I'm not going to write that down. We'll get back to it later. Okay, so what we'd like to do is count how many codes can possibly be crossed off for each error. Well, okay, I guess I will write it down. All right. Well, so there's a Clifford group symmetry, right? There's some Clifford, for any two possible errors, E and E prime, there's some Clifford group operation that will map E to E prime, right? And that Clifford group operation will permute the set of codes. It's not going to change the number of encoded qubits in the code. So it's going to take one of these NK codes to another of these NK codes. So what that means is that all E's will allow us to cross off the same number of codes. Well, except for this redundancy where we have more things. So all these have the same number of codes for which they are in n of s minus s. And this is true regardless of the weight of E. Because this Clifford symmetry is going to relate them, even if they have different weights. Okay? So how many is this? Well, there's E sub n d errors. Well, okay, no, let's put it the other way. So there's n sub n k codes, and each code has how many things in n of s minus s? Well, n of s is size 2 to the n plus k, if you recall from a couple of weeks ago. And s itself is 2 to the n minus k, and it's inside n of s. So n of s minus s is 2 to the n plus k minus 2 to the n minus k. Right? So we have possible total. So if we add up all of the things and all of the n of s's, counting multiplicities, we'll get a total of n sub nk times this. Right? And then if we divide by the total number of errors, we'll find how many times each error appears in this long list. And since each of them appears the same number of times, that's a valid operation. You see? Let's turn it around, right? So we have, so we have E sub nd errors each appears k times. So what we know is that this product, which has all the errors appearing multiple times, this has to be equal to this product. E sub nd. So why isn't it E sub nd? Well, because the things that are appearing in this are not just the things of weight less than d. It's all things, except the identity, will appear in some n of s minus s. All non. So there's actually not E sub nd, there's 4 to the n minus 1. 4 to the n minus 1 possible errors, and here it's 4 to the n minus 1. Okay? Okay, good. And what that tells us is that solving this equation, we find that k is equal to n sub nk times 2 to the n plus k minus 2 to the n minus k, bigger parentheses, over 4 to the n minus 1. Okay? And turns out this ratio, well, you can kind of just neglect these lower order terms, it's actually strictly less than n sub nk times 2 to the n plus k over 4 to the n, 2 to 2n, which is n sub nk over 2 to the n minus k. Okay? So if we cross off this many codes for each of the errors of weight less than d, well, okay, so we might be crossing off the same code multiple times. But at most, the most number of codes we can possibly cross off is E sub nd times k codes, right? And this is equal to, or at least is less than or equal to, E sub nd over 2 to the n minus k times n nk. And if this is less than n sub nk, then a code must be left. Right? So we've crossed off all these codes, but we haven't crossed off, crossed off a lot of codes, we haven't crossed off all of them. If this ratio, E sub nd over 2 to the n minus k, is less than 1. Could be less than or equal to, it could just be less. Okay, so we, the n, as I said, the n sub nk cancels out in the end. We just need to know it's some number. And all that's left is the above part. Does everyone see that? So actually, it turns out that as n and k gets very large, because we have all these exponentials floating around, it's not that there's just one code left over. Actually, most codes are left over. So actually, what that means is that if you take a random code satisfying with parameters satisfying this equation, then with very high probability, you'll find that it actually has the appropriate distance. But okay, does everyone understand this proof? No questions. Okay. So then moving on, it's interesting, in fact, to consider the case where these parameters are large. So we're going to let n go to infinity, k go to infinity, but we're also going to want to correct a lot of errors. So we're going to let d go to infinity too. But we're going to keep these ratios, k over n, and d over n, let's call this let's just leave it at this. Don't want to give it a name. So we'll let these two ratios be constant. Okay, so what this means is that we're getting a big code. It corrects a constant fraction of errors. It has a constant distance. Okay, so this is what's called the good code. So when we do that, well, then, so find some common identities. So the n sub j approaches this quantity, 2 to the n h of j over n, where h of x is this entropy function, binary entropy function. So you can use, for instance, Stirling's formula to show this. And therefore, this sum is dominated by the largest term. And so it's, let's take the log of it. And so it's dominated by the term when j is equal to d minus 1, which is effectively d. So this is about n h of d over n. Okay, that's the log base 2. Okay, and so if we take the log of this equation, we find then that n minus k is greater than n h of d over n plus d, so this is again dominated by the large j term, so it's 3 to the d, which taking log of that is d log 3. Or it's more conventional to divide out by n and to look at all those constant ratios instead of having infinity is greater than infinity. And what we'll find is that a 1 minus r, or let's put it this way, the r on the other side, find that as long as r is less than 1 minus h of d over n minus d over n log 3, then code exists. So this is just taking the asymptotic limit of this Gilbert Barth compound. Okay? So for those of you familiar with classical coding theory, well, if you're used to binary codes, you might be a little bit surprised by the form of this, because it has this log 3 term. And the reason for that is that for qubits, we have these three errors, right, x, y, and z. So effectively, it's acting like a GF4 code. And so this is not, so this is a binary entropy, but this combination is a quaternary entropy, a four-dimensional thing. Okay? Questions? No? Sorry, move on. Okay. So this, as I said, was a hard one to prove. Now let's start to look at, this was a lower bound. It says that codes exist if we have parameters this way. But now let's try to get, see how good we can get the parameters. Let's just set some upper bounds. Sorry, I guess that was a lower bound. Yes, this is an upper bound. Okay. Well, so one kind of obvious thing to do is to count. So if you think about a stabilizer code, right, you say, well, if we have so many error syndromes, we'd like all the errors to have distinct error syndromes. And there's just going to be some limit to that, right? As we get more and more possible errors, we need more and more possible error syndromes, which means we need more and more generators in the stabilizer, which means we have fewer encoded qubits, right? But of course, there's a limit to this because, well, there's, first of all, when you start to do that, you run out of space. But this doesn't apply to everything, right? Because we have this possibility of degenerate codes, so different codes that have different errors that have the same error syndrome for this code. So this first attempt is actually not going to be a general upper bound, as far as we know. This is called the quantum Hamming bound. But it is an upper bound on non-degenerate codes. And this doesn't apply just to stabilizer codes. It applies to all kinds of non-degenerate codes. This is applies to other codes. We'll use this. Okay, so we'll have an n 2 to the k d code. And this is going to apply also for things that aren't, where the encoded subspace is not a power of 2. But I won't worry about that for in terms of writing this. So what must it satisfy? Well, we're going to count the number of errors. But in this case, we only go up to the number of errors that this code can correct. And we're going to multiply that by the number of basis code words in the code. And that has to be less than the total size of the Hilbert space. Okay? And why is that? Well, I kind of just said the answer. For non-degenerate code, different errors must produce linearly independent states. And that means that the total number of errors, so if you take every different error, every different, say, poly error up to weight t. And t, what is t? T is the number of codes in the thing, of errors the code can correct. So d is equal to 2t plus 1. So the number of errors the code can correct times the number of basis code words, the number of linearly independent code words. Well, all of these give linearly independent states, right? So this product must be less than the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay? Everyone see that? So this looks very similar to the Gilbert Markov bound. But the difference is that we only sum from 0 to t, whereas before we were summing from 0 to d minus 1. So we're considering many more errors than the Gilbert-Markov bound, so it's always going to be lower than the quantum mechanic bound. Right, so you have a region where the Gilbert-Markov bound is satisfied. Then as you go up, you get to a region where the Gilbert-Markov bound is not satisfied, but the quantum mechanic bound is still satisfied. So it'll be between the lower bound and the upper bound. And then you go above the quantum mechanic bound, and then you'll know that non-degenerate codes can't exist in that region. But of course, we still don't know if degenerate codes can exist or not. So as it happens, for the standard scenario that I've been talking about, if distance decodes, we don't know of any codes that feed the quantum mechanic bound, degenerate or non-degenerate. But it's still an open question whether they can exist. I mean, in practice, most of the time, you can't achieve a quantum mechanic bound anyway. For d equals 3, you can get right up to it. But for larger distances, you can't. You're kind of stuck somewhere below it. And later today, I'll be showing some more stringent methods that you can use to prove things like that. There's still some possibility that there's some, you know, corner of parameter space. Actually, it's where k is very low and d is relatively large relative to n that we don't know. So it's possible that in that regime there's some codes that actually meet this quantum mechanic bound. Okay. But, and this is pretty straightforward, isn't it? So everyone understands that? And of course, you can look at the asymptotic limit again. And what you get something almost like that. Now I'm going to set, T over N is like the probability of error, right? Because we're correcting errors on this constant fraction P. So if errors are occurring independent of any qubit with probability P, there'd probably be about that many errors. So it's helpful to think of it this way. But of course, this is a code with a minimum distance of 2t plus 1. So anything that's less than t errors we can correct. But anyway, so let's look at this limit. And so what we get, well, it's basically the same formula as before, except d over n is replaced by this p. So we get that r is less than 1 minus h of p minus p log 3. So let's see, I guess I'll write the other theorem on this board and then prove it somewhere else. So this theorem, so okay, so since this quantum Heimlich bound only applies to non-degenerate code, we haven't actually set any bounds on general quantum codes. So for that, we need this next bound called the quantum singleton bound. And again, I could say quantum Heimlich bound analogous to a classical Heimlich bound, quantum singleton bound analogous to a classical singleton bound. This one is occasionally called the nil Laplace bound because they were the first to state it. In the final case. So anyway, the quantum singleton bound says, again, that for an n 2 to the k d code, that we have a constraint. In particular, it says that n minus k is greater than or equal to 2 d minus 1. Okay. And it's useful to note, or it may at some point be useful to note, that this is not just for binary codes. I mean, there's analogs of both the Gilbert-Bartram bound and the quantum Heimlich bound for non-binary codes also. In that case, you just have to replace, we have to replace the 2s by the appropriate dimensional correction and the 3s by the number of errors per qubit. So it's basically d squared minus 1. In this case, you don't have to replace anything. It's still the same formula. Except that these now are d state registers and d state encoded things. And distance means the number of these d state things, like the number of erasures and d state things you correct. So this applies verbatim. These higher dimensional codes. And since I'm going fast, I may even have time to start talking about such things by the end of the class. Okay? So obviously this is a very easy bound to apply. But it's not very stringent, again, in most of the cases. In most of the cases, you can't get very close to it. But we have seen one code that achieves it. Right? Maybe even two. Yeah, we've seen two codes. One was on a homework set. So what are those? Well, the 513 code achieves it, right? N minus k is 4, and 2d minus 1 also 4. And 422 code. And actually, all those 2n minus 2 codes that were on a homework problem. The 422 code 4 minus 2 is 2, and d minus 1 is 1, so 2d minus 1 is 2. Right? Unfortunately, as you get to basically these 2n, so basically this family of codes and this code are the only binary codes that satisfy, aside from some special things called distant zero codes, which are also related to these anyway. And as you get to larger and larger things, you don't satisfy anymore. But as you go to higher dimensions, you can get more and more codes that satisfy this bound. And I'm guessing you probably won't have time to do that today, but next time I'll show you one example of set codes, or a large set of them. Okay, how do we prove this? Okay, so let's start in a very simple spectral case. K equals 1 case. Well, what does it say in this case? It says that n minus 1 is greater than or equal to 2d minus 1. So what is d minus 1? Well, the code has distance d. That means it can correct d minus 1 erasures. Okay, so what happens if n minus 1 is less than 2d minus 1? Well, what that means suppose we have the n qubits of the code here, right? And suppose we erase d minus 1 of them. That means we can still recover the remaining ones. Okay? And suppose this then is also d minus 1. And then we can, if we just had these qubits, we could also recover the code. But you see from this argument that if we can recover the code from this set of qubits and from this set of qubits, then we could do that independently, right? And you get two copies of the encoded state. So we have a coding machine. We would take a qubit, encode it using this Maxwell code, and then divide it in half and get two copies of the state. So So let's make that a little more precise to get the actual numbers exactly right. So if we have n minus d minus 1 qubits, we can recover the state. And then so that means that if d minus 1, so what we can do is we can split it into the n minus d minus 1 qubits and then d minus 1 left over. But if the d minus 1 qubits are also greater than this amount, then we can get two copies. So what does that say? Well, that says that we can't have n less than or equal to 2d minus 1. n is greater than 2d minus 1. Or in other words, n minus 1 is greater than or equal to 2d minus 1.
That's where the 1 was that I was worrying about.
Okay. See that? That's a straightforward argument. Yeah.
It means that we can get the original code from less than half of the number of qubits.
Well, right. So if the distance is too large, then we can correct lots and lots of iterations, and we could divide the whole code in half, but we get two copies of the code. Okay, that's the argument. But if the distance is small, we can't do that. Right? Because then the number of qubits that we've erased in order to still recover the code is not enough itself to correct, to recover another copy.
I mean, is there any code that we can get the original code from less than half a qubit that there is in the code?
Well, sure. I mean, so long as you don't insist on being able to get it from an arbitrary set of less than half a qubit. So a trivial example is, I'll encode 1 qubit and 10 qubits as follows. I put the qubit in the first qubit, and then the rest of 9 qubits are all 0. Okay? And then if I have the first qubit around, I can obviously recover the original state. But if I have any of the other qubits, that doesn't happen. So that's a case where I can recover from less than half, but it has to be just the right half. Right. So this is the point, is that for distance z code, we want to be able to correct for any array from any set of d minus 1 qubits. Other questions? Okay. So now let's move on to the higher case. This is a bit harder. And to do this, I'm going to have to introduce some things about entropy. And I guess this is not necessarily a standard topic in the introductory quantum computing course. But I don't really want to go into detail, so I'm just going to write down a bunch of properties. They're not very hard properties, or at least the ones I'm going to use are not very hard. Okay, so the definition of fundamental entropy is S of rho is equal to minus trace rho log rho. Okay? This von Neumann entropy is really useful in quantum information. And if you want to do anything else in quantum information, you should definitely learn it. I don't know why it's not in the introductory class. It's a lot of things that need to be in the introductory class, I guess, but there's only so much time to do them. So it's related to both physics and information theory. It's basically the same entropy that appears in thermodynamics. If you look at, say, the Gibbs entropy, some general case of that. And it's also the same as, or at least it generalizes, the classical Shannon entropy that you see in information theory, which tells how much information you can put in a message, or how much redundancy you need to correct a code going through a noisy channel. So what are the properties of this von Neumann entropy? Well, first of all, the entropy of a pure state is 0. That should be relatively easy to see, right? Because, you can consider the pure state to be, you can diagonalize it, right? Put the 1 in the upper left corner and zeros elsewhere. And then log of that, so the place where we have zeros, this one is going to be 0, and so it's going to kill this infinite log. You have to take some kind of limiting thing to define it, right? And then log of 1 is just 0. So you get a 0 in the other place also. So what is that? S of psi is equal to 0. So another thing that's true is that if you have a global pure state and you look at half of it, well, then the entropy of one half is equal to the entropy of the other half.
Really,
E is pure state. Okay. So another property I'll need is that the maximum value of the entropy is equal to the logarithm of the dimension. So that is the log of rank, and that's the number of qubits that we're working with. Okay, and we have equalities here if rho is completely mixed. The identity over the dimension for normalization. But why is that? Well, clearly, rho's identity is kind of the maximally mixed state. You need some experience here with the entropy to see that that's going to be the maximum. But if you do have that, then we'll 1 over the dimension times log of 1 over the dimension. And then we sum that along the diagonal. Log of 1 over the dimension, that's the number of qubits, and that's just some constant. We sum that over the dimension, so it's 1 over the dimension. Well, anyway, it's if you write it down, it's trivial to see that the entropy of this state is, in fact, the number of qubits. Okay. I guess there was a minus sign there. I left out that spoken proof. so these are the really easy properties. The next property is a little harder, but I think it's still not very hard to prove. And you can tell it's a little harder because it has a name. It's called subadditivity. Additivity, yes, that's all right. And so it says if you have a bipartite system, the entropy of the whole thing is less than or equal to the entropy of the first part plus the entropy of the second part. And this is pretty intuitive because if you have a joint system, there might be correlations between the two sides, right? And correlations will decrease the total entropy. But if you just look at one half, you won't see those correlations. So the entropy could be high. In fact, you can have, in the quantum case, you can even have extreme thing. This doesn't happen classically. Classically, S of rho AB is always greater than or equal to S of rho A. But quantum mechanically, S of rho AB could be zero because the whole thing is a pure state, even though the two parts are very mixed. The last property, which thankfully I won't need for the proof, is called strong subadditivity. I'm including it for completeness, simply because it's, you know, one of the most famous properties of the entropy. One of the reasons it's famous is actually very hard to prove. But like I said, I don't actually need it today. And what this says is if you have a three-part system, then S of rho ABC plus S of rho B plus S of rho AB plus S of rho BC. Okay? And classically, this is kind of trivial because of what I said, that S of rho AB is greater than S of rho A. But quantum mechanically, not at all. Okay? So that's the entropy. Okay, so how am I going to use this? Hopefully I'll fit on this board. Okay, so we're going to do something kind of similar, but we have to do it for the larger k case. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the qubits in the code, and we're going to break them up into three pieces. So we already know that n is greater than 2d minus 1. So what we're going to do is we're going to make, this is going to be d minus 1 qubits, and this is system A. And here we have another d minus 1 qubits, and this is system B, And then what's left over would be system C, and that's n minus 2 d minus 1 qubits, and which we know is at least 1 qubit in size. And I, as I said, this applies to the higher dimensional code, so just replace qubit everywhere with qdit, the d-dimensional thing. Okay? And we're going to encode a max, not a maximum entangled state, but half of a maximum entangled state. And the other half of that is R. And since there's k encoded qubits in the code, R has to consist of k qubits. So that's where we're getting the size of the code, the size of the encoded space. Okay? Everyone understand this basic structure? Okay, so globally we have a pure state. So what does that mean? That means for instance, it means that S of RA is equal to S of BC. And what I mean by this is rho RA, so the density matrix on RA and the density matrix on B and C. And similarly, S of RB is equal to S of AC. Well, let's see, what else do we know? Well, we know that since we encoded a maximally entangled state, the reference system R is completely mixed. So that implies that the entropy of R is equal to the number of qubits in it, which is k. Okay. Okay. So, so I guess there's one other property I need of the entropy, which is that if we have a tensor product state, then the entropy of the joint state is equal to the sum of entropies of the pieces. So this is the, so this is the equality condition in subadditivity. So remember I said this could be less because there might be correlations between the two. So the tensor product case is a case where you don't have correlations. Okay. So applying that, well, do we have any tensor product states here? Well, yes, in fact, we do. We know, remember, from the quantum error correction conditions, or one version of them, that the ability to correct d minus 1 erasures means that any d minus 1 qubits in the code have no information about the encoded state. Okay? So what that means, in this case, so that implies that A and R are totally uncorrelated. So S of AR is equal to S of A plus S of R. Okay? This is where we're using the fact that the code has distance D. And similarly for B. So applying subadditivity, well, this is equal to S of AR, which is equal to, so up here, S of BC. And that, we know, is equal to, it's not S of A plus S of B, it's A plus S of R. This is equal to S of, less than or equal to S of B plus S of C. We don't know if B and C are entangled. In fact, they probably are. Or at any rate, correlated. Okay? So we have S of A plus S of R is less than or equal to S of B plus S of C. So let me write that by saying that S of R, which is equal to K, is less than or equal to S of C plus S of B minus S of A. Okay? And we can do the same thing for B, right? Switching A and B. When we do that, we get the same thing, except that it's plus S of A minus S of B. Okay? So it could be that S of A is equal to S of B. It could be that one of them is bigger than the other. But no matter what, these two things in brackets can't both be greater than 0. Right? So therefore, we know that K is less than or equal to S of C. And, well, what's S of C? Well, we don't know what S of C is, but we know that it's at most equal to the number of qubits in C. How many qubits are there in C? Well, there's n minus 2 b minus 1 qubits. And that is a singleton bound. Okay? So basically, the upshot is, well, if you look at the k equals 1 case, that's the no cloning theorem. That's all it's telling you. And then if you look at the higher k cases, it says that each encoded qubit you want to add requires you, well, if you want to keep the distance the same, it's requiring you to add one more physical qubit, which seems like a pretty sensible requirement. But it, as you can see, it requires a little bit of work to prove it. Which is, I mean, in classical case, it's actually kind of trivial, this bound, although it's still important. But in the quantum case, it's a little more work. Yeah?
Also, Daniel, the fact that, for example, the imported qubits can be recovered from BC, right?
Yes.
That implies that R is in tensor with A for some proof, right?
Well, yeah, but it's a proof that we've already done, because we had the quantum error correction conditions, right? And one version of those said, as I said, that if you can correct for the erasure of some set of qubits, then those qubits have no information at all, no correlation with the encoded state. Okay? And R here kind of represents the encoded state. If you make a measurement on it, project it onto something, that you're basically projecting the encoded state onto some value. And doing that should have no effect on A, because A is always the same.
Yeah, so you think that you've already seen a proof that if you can recover from one part, then the other part has no information.
Yes, that's right.
No, I mean, yeah. Not that you cannot recover from the other part, because that will be no cloning, but that has no information.
That's right, that has no information. If you apply the quantum error correction condition, that's what you get. Other questions? Okay, well, this is time to take a break. So we'll be back in the usual, 5 minutes.